there a better way to start this?
No.
Okay. Welcome to a special live episode of Commerce Chefs. We have, well, obviously we have the better half of the Commerce Chefs, Mr. Tom
Kyle Duca.
Oh, that's right. Nice. Yeah, good. Okay, that's it. But the real guests, we've got Dan Park, the CEO of Clutch.ca. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is awesome.
It's going to be good.
Yes.
And we also have like a few...
A live audience.
Yeah, live audience.
It's fantastic.
It's like The Price is Right.
Absolutely.
Come on down. Okay. Not in the notes.
You get a car. Everyone gets a car.
Oh.
There you go.
Imagine that. Everybody here walked away with a car.
You didn't know. Okay. So Dan is the CEO of Clutch.ca, and I've got that thing where I awkwardly introduce you and you just...
I'll just sit here.
You sit here. And we just zoom in real close to your face.
Yeah.
Okay, brother. Okay. The CEO of Clutch.ca, also a venture partner at Azure Capital Partners. Previously, you were the GM and the head of Uber Eats Canada, among a laundry list. And I wrote that because I just couldn't keep up with the board member, everything that you're part of. I wrote, gives Elon a run for his money.
Yeah, I said that's not true.
So. But I think it's true. So I'm good. Clutch.ca, though, outside of all the other things that you've done and accomplished, I want to focus on Clutch.ca for a second. For those maybe that are also like, you know, maybe have not... like looked on the internet, it's a thing. Clutch.ca, Canada's first and largest online car retailer.
That's right.
Yeah, thousands of cars sold through a website.
Tens of thousands of cars sold through a
website. Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands.
We will dig into that because like I just want to appreciate that like people don't buy cars through websites.
Yeah,
they do.
It's funny, when I first kind of embarked on this journey, one of the questions, you know, surveying people in the industry, hey, do you think people will buy cars online? And people are like, no, absolutely not. You have to test drive a car. But, you know, I think that's, you look back over the last 20 years around e-commerce generally, 15 years ago, buying a pair of shoes online was insane.
Yeah.
How could you buy a pair of shoes online without actually trying those on? A TV, I think, is the best example. You literally can't see the picture quality of the TV unless you go see that TV in person.
Yeah.
You can't see the picture quality of a TV on another TV. And so that's happening online. And so I think naturally most things can move online. Real estate's moving online, and the second largest purchase you'll make for most people will be a car. And I think if you deliver the transparency, the details, again, 10 years ago buying a diamond online was insane. So you know, the stretch now to buy a car online isn't actually that crazy.
That's wild. Okay, we're going to dig into more of that. The other piece that we're going to dig into, because apparently you've know a bit about raising capital. Clutch has raised over $200 million in capital to launch some explosive growth. That's a few million dollars. I don't know if anybody in the room is interested in $200 million, but if you are, we'll talk about that.
Yep. So,
and then the other thing, I just need to throw this in because this might be the most important piece for everyone in the room. As very loyal Canadians, you guys are now partnered with the NHL.
Yes, yeah.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, officially used car retailer. I can talk about that because I think that's an important piece of it as well. Because from a brand perspective, and I can talk about trust because trust is such an important piece of a large purchase item. And one of those things and one of the decisions we made early on was like, look, we need a partner that can help us build that trust as we build our product, as we build our following. Yeah. That was an important partnership.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Okay, we're going to dig in.
Cool.
I'm excited to unpack, and what we were saying earlier on tonight is kind of like unpacking how you guys have innovated and worked through those barriers of high consideration, high complexity, and then also unpack, you know, about funding and when, why, how. But before we do that, just like give us the, let's just step it back.
Okay.
What's your story? Give us a little, the Dan story.
I mean, how far back, I guess.
Like where were you born?
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. We'll go that far ounces. Back. Okay. Born in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories.
Really?
So small town, northern kid, was one of the only Korean, I think the only Korean family growing up in northern Canada. My dad was an architect. I wanted to be an architect. I wanted to build things. He said that architecture takes talent and you don't have it. So I decided to be an entrepreneur instead. Started in finance.
That would be the best takeaway for tonight.
Maybe, yeah.
Going to entrepreneurship.
So started in finance. So worked in New York for a number of years on Wall Street doing tech M&A. moved into venture capital, investing in startups. And, you know, I loved working with entrepreneurs, but felt like I wanted to be one of them.
Yeah.
You know, be sitting on the other side of the table just felt like, you know, felt like I was missing out. And having now been on the other side, you know, there's no, you know, and I'm talking to a group of entrepreneurs, and there's just no other rush than, you know, the wins that come along with building a business, and seeing your product in the wild. Yeah. And every day I drive along, and sometimes I see a Clutch license plate, and I'm like, that's us. That was our team. Yeah. That's awesome. And so I think it's just so satisfying. And so that's kind of the journey, kind of in a nutshell. You know, ultimately, you know, really passionate about building teams, really passionate about building consumer products. Landed at Clutch because, you know, ultimately cars are your second largest consumer product. And in Canada, there's this giant white space. In the US, there's a bunch of brands around used car retail, and car retail generally. In Canada, there's no brand. I'm not sure where everyone's from, but assuming folks are from across the country, and if I pulled every one of you and said, hey, look, where would you buy a used car? You know, the person that grew up in Montreal versus Vancouver versus Toronto versus Edmonton would say something completely different. Yeah. Whereas in the US, there's a few brands that people have recognized. And so we thought there was an opportunity to create that cohesive experience around used car buying in this country, for something that is really, really painful. 90% of people hate going to a dealership. Gallup comes out with a poll every year ranking professions on a scale of honesty and ethics. And at the very top is always nurses. At the bottom, used car salespeople. And so thought there was an opportunity there. If you want to go sell a car, you have to go to a Tim Hortons parking lot and meet some stranger and try to like haggle for a deal. I mean, this is 2023. There's got to be a better way. And so that was really the genesis of all of this. You know, spending folks, I have kids, you have kids. The idea of going to a dealership and spending 5 hours on a Saturday seems unreasonable, particularly if you drag your kids along. And so why not be able to do that from the comfort of your home? And so that's the value proposition that we bring to this industry, and we're trying to change the way that Canadians buy and sell used cars.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
I mean, I think unless a dealership has like free hot dogs or something like that.
I love a free hot dog.
I mean, we'll do anything for free hot dogs.
Especially if it's kid time.
That's right.
No, but in all seriousness, you kind of started with this idea of polling the audience. Hey, would you ever buy a car online?
Yeah.
You know, absolutely not. So did that ever dissuade you from starting this, or what kind of gave you that push to know, nope, there's a pain point here, there's a fear here, there's a frustration, there's a need, I've got to go fill that?
I think that if there's a theme from this conversation, I think one of the themes is you don't know until you try it. And I think there's a lot of things over the course of history, and even kind of the more recent history, around things that seemed insane. Like, do you want to go jump in someone's random car to like get a ride somewhere? Or do you want to stay at someone's apartment that you don't know, right? There's a bunch of consumer behavior that 10 years ago seemed crazy at the time. And so I think until you try it, you don't know. And we originally started the model because the industry is so rooted in the belief that test drives are needed to sell a car.
Right.
But if you think about what the reason why consumers will take a test drive is because you don't trust the person selling the thing to you. And the average consumer doesn't know a ton about cars, and getting in the car and driving it down the street really only tells you a few things: that the brakes work, it goes.
It has a blinker.
Well, you can't really see that. The air conditioning blows cold, and you know what it kind of looks like generally. And so a lot of that, if you trust the person or the company that is selling that to you, can be skipped. And if you have data and the information, and the web and the internet provides so much of that now, and we can provide these really high definition photos, and we have complete transparency around any imperfection that exists around the vehicle. And so if there's a scratch, you can zoom in on the scratch and see, okay, that's that scratch. And so when the car arrives in your driveway and gets dropped off, you can be like, okay, that meets my expectation, because or exceeds my expectation, because everything was super transparent. And so until you try it, you don't know. And so we were under the belief that you needed a test drive. So we actually embarked on test drives at the beginning. So we had this concierge service where we bring the car to you, you could test drive it, and then if you didn't like it, we'd send it back. Incredibly operationally intensive. And you know, 40 to 50% of the time, the consumer didn't want the car. And so the crazy thing was back in, you know, call it early pandemic, so 2020, Ours is a regulated business, so we have regulators in every province, and so we're a highly regulated business. And because it took us time to get our license, and because of a bunch of regulatory things, they were said, okay, you can't do this anymore because their test drive model actually doesn't fit the regulations. And so we're like, oh, geez, what do we have to do? So this is a little bit reminiscent of Uber. So we actually shut down our test drives because we had to from a regulatory perspective. And then literally the day we did that, our sales started taking off. And so it was actually, it was funny because I think a bunch of dealers actually caused that to happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, unbeknownst to them, trying to shut us down actually created an acceleration for us, which was kind of interesting. But, you know, consumers, every consumer approaches the world with their own view of with their own experience, their own view of the world. And, you know, so many times I hear people being like, I would never buy that, right? Or I would never do that. There's a lot of things I wouldn't buy because it's, I'm not the target market, but there's like billions of people in the world. And so just because you personally aren't going to do that doesn't mean that 100 other people will not do something completely different than you. And so until you put it out in the market, it's really hard, from a consumer perspective, it's really hard to know whether or not the thing that you're doing actually has signal. And so that's been a big foundational learning for the business, is until you try, you don't know. And I have a bunch of examples that we can go into, but you know, that's kind of, you know, the core of how we think about things is, you know, we have a question around something, well, why don't we try it and see what happens, right? And see what happens.
I don't think though that that is everybody's initial reaction. I think often, and to the entrepreneurs in the room, you're like, heck yeah, we're gonna try it. If it fails, okay, we'll go to the next one. But we're kind of weird. A lot of people will look at something and go, there's a risk there. If I fail, how will I look? How will I feel? I'm not gonna go there. But sort of around that trust point is like, you knew there was something to meet.
Right.
And you pun intended, you drove at it.
Yeah.
There'll be more. Okay, so
that's the end of the quota. We're out.
So you've launched. You're going. Sales increase when test drives are taken off the table. How do you go about ideating, strategizing, planning, and executing a trust building movement? Because I think there is, at least in my mind, maybe others here, there is a pretty sleazy outlook on other alternatives, let's say, that are out there, of where you would buy or find a used car online.
Tim Hortons parking lot.
Tim Hortons parking lot, or more remote places for others. Don't go there. So what did you and the team talk about? How were you focused on making sure that you could continually build trust, even before you started partnering with big organizations like the NHL?
Yeah, I mean, early on, and I think this applies to every company that's delivering any product, you have to focus on the product. I mean, if you have a great, and for us, it's cars, obviously, so if we have a great car, a really high-quality car that you can trust, that, you know, if you want to take right off the lot and drive it across the country, you don't have any, you know, hesitation around that. If you can start with that, that's core to everything. And so one of the metrics we track religiously is NPS. And so literally anytime anyone fills out an NPS survey, I get a Slack notification. Anytime fills out a Google survey, we get a Slack notification. And so like all our Google reviews go to the entire team, and we're able to like track those on a real-time basis. And we have a very, very fast feedback loop around consumer experience. And we have an NPS of 82, which is quite high.
Yeah.
That means like 90% of people are rating us either a 9 or 10 in terms of experience.
Yeah.
And that's both on the sell side and on the buy side. And so our team has been very committed to product experience and product quality. And if you can start with that foundation, because ultimately we're selling a commodity, and a lot of people are. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different clothing brands and drink brands and, you know, glasses brands.
Yeah.
And so you got to differentiate yourself somehow. And for us, it's around quality and experience. And if those are the things that you're focused on, then, you know, do everything around the organization to rally the team around those things. And like, for me, like I continue to like talk to customers individually, and my team doesn't love that, but I do that just to make sure that I stay connected with the consumer. And anytime there's any complaints, right, I'm the one that addresses them. So I think those are important. And I don't do all of them, but I certainly do a subset of them. And I think that connects you to the consumer. It highlights the areas where you need to improve. And it also gives you a feedback loop around what you know, from a car perspective, what the customers care about and what we don't, and what we need to be able to be more focused on and what we don't need to be focused on. So I think that's really important.
Yeah. I wanted to dive in with you on this, speaking of kind of like shifting a little bit into like complexity and consideration. Yeah. You know, one of the through lines, whether you sell a car through a website, which is probably the extreme case, or whether you're selling clothing, which has complexity, I want to try it on, I want to test drive it.
Yep.
Or with high consideration, you've got a product that is, you know, isn't just a $10 purchase. How did you guys navigate and innovate through high consideration, high complexity? Because I think that correlates to any brand, right?
Yeah. For us, it's transparency. Again, okay. You know, our website, if you go online, very, like, we have 360 spins of the car, that all that technology we built ourselves. We have, you know, we call them hotspots of any imperfections on the vehicle, and so you can really zoom in. But in addition to that, there's a full vehicle history, so there's a Carfax report that you can download immediately. The pricing is transparent, there's no hidden fees, so you look at the pricing, it's like, okay, I'm going to go get this car, and that's what I'm going to pay for it. 9 times out of 10, you walk into a dealership, that's not the price you're going to pay for it.
Right.
And so price transparency, product transparency, and then, you know, being very, you know, upfront about exactly what product you're serving has been kind of core to everything that we're doing.
Yeah.
From an experience standpoint, that's where, you know, partnerships like the NHL have come in handy, where, you know, people call us and like, is this thing a scam? Right. And you're like, well, we're partnered with the NHL. So if you're a fledgling brand that needs brand trust, we associate ourselves with another trusted brand that helps us kind of use that halo. But ultimately, those are, I would say, secondary to the product and the product quality and the experience that you get online. And again, for us, it's all about transparency. I think that's the thing that, at least in our industry, was lacking. And so that's the thing that we really focused on.
Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of going into like what, whether it's a car again, or whether it's clothing or whatever it might be, is like understanding what the real barriers are for that product.
Yeah. So if you have, you know, I think the higher end clothing, and particularly like technical clothing brands, I think they do a good job on really zooming in on the, so you can see the fabric quality and you can almost like, you know, virtually touch it. Right.
Yeah.
And I think those things are important, or you show, you know, the pictures of water beating off like that. I think that is indicative of, okay, this is what this product does in a technical setting. Right. And so I think there's ways that companies can highlight product benefits that normally you think are only available in the physical world in an online kind of environment. And I think that's the trick, that being able to translate that really well. You know, there's a few companies out there that have done virtual fittings, particularly in like the glasses space, that I think are pretty impressive from like a tech perspective. Yeah. And so I think, you know, to the extent that you can highlight the product features that people would want to experience in person virtually, then I think you're better off.
So is that next virtual test drive?
Trust drives?
With your $4,000 ski goggles?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Free idea. So I think the interesting thing for me here, though, high consideration product, but at a certain point, though, the product itself isn't at origin yours.
Yeah.
However, you have a process of reclaiming and repurposing and reframing. It's a lot of re's. That piece to make it more appealing, to connect better, and to build trust outside of that product somewhere else on a completely separate platform, same thing, but the experience and the perception of that is completely different.
Yeah, so again, for the hardest thing to do in this industry for us is to price the product or price the good. Used cars, every single SKU that we have is different. So two Toyota Corollas are never the same. Every SKU that goes through our process is entirely different. And to price that SKU requires an incredible amount of data. And so we built a really robust data set based on a bunch of machine learning algorithms. And, you know, we ingest a bunch of data to be able to spit out a price for your car in a real-time basis so we can acquire those cars from the public. We're now putting about 100,000 offers per month into the Canadian market. And combination of refresh offers and new offers, but we have this funnel of cars that are being priced on a daily basis, and from there we can then estimate the amount of cost that it's going to require to actually get that car up to our standard. And so we have we call it a clutch standard. Every car that goes through our facility has this 210-point inspection. We replace tires and brakes and rotors and windshields and air filters and cosmetic, and we'll do kind of everything that needs to be done on the vehicle to that meets their, our standard. And then we put all of that on our website to make sure that that's communicated. And so we communicate a lot of that. And a big piece of this kind of trust building is this, we have a 10-day money-back guarantee. And so, you know, I think hard to do in a lot of industries, but in particularly ours, but if you don't like the car, you just bring it back. And so that's kind of the, the biggest value proposition is like, hey, look, like it's a big value purchase, but if you don't like it, you can just bring it back. And because our product quality is so high, our return rates are sub 5%.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good. Well, and that's a digging into right. What are the real barriers for the consumer? Hey, and like, how do we go and find a solution for that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so, and I think we've done a lot of conversations with customers. And again, I think that feedback loop that we have, because we're talking to customers every day, allows us to say, okay, well, these are the pain points, or these are the friction and barriers that the consumer is coming across. Okay, how do we address those things? What's the issue? And so, you know, we had the 10-day money back guarantee, but we also extended now a 90-day complimentary warranty, because we're like, okay, you know, sure, if something goes wrong in the first 10 days, it's one thing, but like, what about the first 3 months? And generally 3 months, you know, is an adequate amount of time to know whether or not the car is in good condition or not.
Yeah. No, that's huge to take the big concerns and fears and barriers, just take them off the table.
Yeah. And almost put your money where your mouth is and say, hey, like if you got a good product here, like, you know, trust us, look at it. It's going to be great.
Yeah. If you can't stand behind it, why have the
flashy
show of it?
I want to, we've got just time for a couple more questions here, but I want to just shift us a bit into funding.
Okay.
Totally kind of changing gears. That's second pun. Third. How many times have I said shifting gears today? I don't know. Not intentional.
I've never heard you say shifting gears.
Well, here's one. What? Okay. So if you take the O out of founder, it's basically funder.
Right.
Which,
That's
right. I prepared that one. Well, the founders in the
genius.
Room.
Yeah, genius. Genius.
Everyone is leaving. Wow. But so many founders we talked to, right? It's like so much the role is to go raise funds.
Yeah.
And like, it's a funny joke, but it's like legit part of the job, right? So tell us kind of like, you spent lots of years in VC, you've raised a ton of capital. What do we learn? Like, what do we need to know?
If you can avoid taking capital,
It's not worth it. It's going to go.
I unfortunately have a business where every unit that I buy is about $25,000 to $30,000. So I had to take capital. If you do not have that, please do not take capital. I think, you know, the question on whether or not you want to take outside money, I think is really a personal, it's partly a business choice depending on the business you're in. But then after that, it's really a personal choice. If, you know, there's, The financial outcome of, you know, owning 10% of a $1 billion business versus 100% of a $100 million business is the same.
Right.
Right. But the $1 billion business requires a bunch of money, and with that comes a bunch of strings, and you lose a bunch of control. And so there is cost to taking money, no surprise.
Yeah.
And so I think if there's any advice, take it wisely, take it when you need it. You know, spend the time focusing on the fundamentals of the business. I mean, you know, this last 18 months for us as a team and for me personally was probably the most challenging 18 months of my professional career from a fund, because of the funding landscape.
Wow.
You know, valuations and e-commerce companies have like, you know, gone crazy and, you know, plummeted. And so there's been a lot of turmoil around the VC landscape, particularly for companies at our stage, so Series B and C and beyond. And so if you're not at that stage, good, great. That's a win. The pressure to grow and the pressure to scale at VC level pace is intense. Yeah. It adds to some excitement. But you know, when we raised our last round, you know, we basically within 6 months hired 300 people. And so what happens then is like, you've got 60, we had, I think at one point, 70% of the workforce had like less than 3 months of experience of our team. And so, and you had like new people hiring new people and then new people trying to train new people. And so you just have like mass chaos and inefficiency, but you kind of go through that phase and then you have to like reset the foundation. You know, I always tell my team, look, like growing at 4X is actually really hard. Exponential growth for humans is really hard to understand. And so like, growing at 4x is, you know, you're doing 100 things today. Now, like next, well, this year you can do, you know, 100 things. Next year you got to go do 400 things. And you're like, okay,
right.
Well,
right.
How, you know, like everything, every how you were doing those 100 things has to fundamentally change to do 400 things or 500 things.
Yeah.
When you're doing like 10, 20% growth, like conceptually, okay, I'm doing 100 things and next year I need to now do 110 things, right? Like, that's like you can figure out how to do that. And yeah. So that is a much less stressful, more peaceful existence in many ways.
Yeah.
Much more efficient. It's much more, you know, not only capital efficient, but it's also just more like people resource efficient. And so my advice is, you know, for anyone who wants to embark on the VC journey, you know, hats off to you. I think, you know, I think that it comes with its challenges, but it also comes with a lot of reward and it could be very rewarding. But if you don't need to take it, there's also something to be said about having, you know, 100% control of your business or near 100% control of the business. And I see folks nodding that are like, yes, I agree with that. And so, you know, I don't think there's a right answer for anyone. And I think really only in hindsight can you like look back and say that was the right answer. But, you know, I think, you know, my advice is that some businesses are more geared towards VC capital. And if that's the case, then maybe that's an avenue that you want to pursue. Others are less so, and so don't try to force it, I would say. And pick your partners wisely. In the same way, you know, we at the dinner we talked a lot about how, you know, founder relationship is like, or co-founder relationship is like marriage.
Yeah.
Or you guys are, you know, like married, you know, 15 years strong.
Are we, yeah.
still need a few
this
years.
This is a whole nother podcast unpacking
exactly,
that.
Yeah, figure that out. But, you know, but you're like your funder, your investor relationships are just as deep. You know, yeah. I spend a lot of time with my investors, and I think like, you know, this last year I probably spent 75% of my time on fundraising and investor related activities.
Wow.
Which is, it's important for the business, but it's not like directly contributing to building the business, which for me is, I think for a lot of folks, myself included, can be far frustrating.
Yeah.
I would say that advice is right on the money.
How long were you thinking about that one?
Yeah. Probably about 35
the whole
seconds.
Time. Yeah. The whole time.
I didn't hear a word you said, Dan.
I said funding, and he said, what pun can I make?
I love it. I love it.
But there is this sort of, sex appeal with funding and raising money.
Yeah, it's overrated. It's overrated. It's overrated. It's overrated.
I was not expecting that from you.
Really? Okay. It's overrated.
Yeah.
We get into the good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly, I mean, the ability to scale really quickly is super fun.
Yeah.
I don't know if I, you know, personally, I mean, given my business, there's actually no other way to really do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's also, maybe grass is always greener, but I look at some of the founders that, you know, haven't raised any capital and, you know, own 90% or close to 100%. And I'm like, oh, that's nice. Right. So there's definitely, you know, again, there's pros and cons. I don't think there's a right answer. Every business is unique and has different capital needs and working capital cycles. And half of that 200 was debt in order for us to support the inventory. And so, you know, again, I think it's very much a personal choice, you know, after whether or not the business makes sense from a VC landscape or not. So
good. Okay, we got to wrap up.
Okay.
But I want to know if there's any parting wisdom, any kind of like just golden nuggets you want to leave us with, the founders in the room.
I think, you know, you've rubbed off on me. It's, man, I feel
you
like
you can do it. You can do it.
It's more about the journey than the destination. maybe more about the drive, I guess.
Yeah,
you gotta have drive. Gotta have drive.
Take the journey. You know,
so,
the road less traveled.
No, I mean, you know, I think building businesses is super fun. It certainly has its ups and downs. I think, you know, the thing that's, I think most people in this room could agree with, and the people you do it with is probably the most important thing. And so pick your partners wisely.
Shotgun.
I think, there you go. And so, you know, the team that I've been fortunate to surround myself with has been awesome. And so that's made it infinitely more fun. I don't think you shouldn't waste your time trying to like make something that doesn't work. So, I would say enjoy the journey. You know, take the ups and downs for what it's worth. I personally enjoy the adrenaline rush of it all. Like the wins the wins are pretty awesome. The lows suck, but
yeah.
The fact that the lows suck makes the wins more fun. You know, who knows at the end of this road, who knows what this all becomes, but
yeah.
You know, if you deliver a great product and you focus on the consumer, you know, our philosophy is that eventually it'll win.
That's clutch.
Cool.
Just keep the fuel in the tank. One more question.
Yes.
After all of this, mm-hmm. architect or entrepreneur?
I guess in many ways I ended up with the best of both worlds. Yeah. The architects get to build stuff and we're building something and
yeah.
maybe it's not a building, but
That's true.
I think my dad's still, I think he's still proud.
Fantastic. Oh, Dan, thank you so right, much. Cool. Everyone, thank you so much for being here. Dan Park, the CEO of Clutch.ca and a fantastic pun maker. Tom.
Not rivaled by Tom, for sure.
Well, always, so, there you always go. A pleasure.
Always a pleasure. I was holding back.
Yeah, so good.
It's great.
We got time for like maybe 2-3 questions. If anyone wants to ask Dan a question, I'd love to feel a little AMA. Who's got a clutch question? Yeah.
I'm curious, like from your perspective, originally as an investor and then moving in more as a founder, like how is, because you mentioned that it's overrated.
Yeah.
Like, how's your perception changed over
time? Oh man, I mean, if I would be such a better investor now that I've gone, I mean, the amount of founder empathy that I now have versus before doing this is like through the roof. So I think that's where, you know, I feel like looking back on my time as a VC, I'm just like, wow, I could have just been a lot better at that job. The VC world is amazing. I tell VCs these days who are, you know, right now, everyone's about profitability. I'm sure people are hearing it, right? Like yeah. it was all about growth and now it's all about profitability. But I always tell VCs, I'm like, hey, look, if all companies were profitable, you wouldn't have a job.
Right.
So, you know, growth is still very important, and there is definitely a world, like there's definitely a need, and you know, VCs have sparked so much innovation in, you know, not only in this country, but in this world. Yeah. So I think they definitely serve a purpose. But you know, my view is that, you know, from an entrepreneur's perspective, I think, you know, you get into this, you know, you have a vision for the product, you have, you know, a way that you want to do things, and having a bunch of people to answer to, you know, requires a bunch of management and a bunch of time, which is, you know, for us, it's worth the trade-off and it's, you know, definitely something we need to do. But for some other folks, it might not be worth that trade-off. And again, that's kind of where it goes down to personal preference and what you ultimately want to build and how you want to structure you and your team and your co-founder, how you want to structure your life.
Yeah. Great. That's really good. Good question. Yeah. Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah. How are you thinking about AI now? And what are you hoping it can do for your business?
Good question.
So I think speed to product development is going to increase, which I think is really helpful from an iteration standpoint. Like, I think what you see on our website is probably 10% of the technology that we built behind the scenes. So for us, there's an incredible amount of technology that goes into receiving vehicles, tracking where those vehicles are, what amount and what kind of reconditioning is going into that vehicle, and then on the sales side, there's a bunch of, you know, automation that happens, and then on the pricing side, that is all driven by machine learning, and we have a bunch of data sets that we parse on a daily basis, and so there's a lot there. I think, I don't know, it's so early for, you know, GPT-4 is like in its like nascency still. And I'm actually very curious to see where this all evolves to, because, you know, I almost feel like this is like internet in 1998 or 2000, right? Like it's still, we're just scratching the surface. And so like the only thing that I can think of right now or like conceptually use it for is like customer service automation and like handling all the volume that we have from like people asking questions. And I think you can automate a lot of that, but I feel like that's like just like the tip of the iceberg, right? Because like, you know, in 2001 or 98 or whatever, like, you know, dial-up internet, you weren't thinking about, okay, can I like do a FaceTime call and, you know, wear your ski goggles and, you know, you know, download a full-length feature film in 4K to your phone. Like, it's like those things weren't even conceptually possible. So I'm I'm actually like nervous for what GPT-4 can do and beyond, because
who knows, right?
Yeah. Like, I hurt my hand. I asked, I don't know if this is the right thing to do, but I asked ChatGPT for a diagnosis, and I think it was pretty good. I have a delayed hematoma in my hand, so I don't know, at least according to AI. I should probably go see a doctor, but for now,
don't do it.
That's what I'm going with. So who knows? Like, I don't know, but I think there's a few use cases where, you know, I think it's really easy to build product. My co-founder, like, basically built a car shuttling app in like a week using AI and a bunch of like different tools. I don't know how he did it, but he did it, and now it works. And so, like, literally overnight, a year ago, we tried to hire a team of like 10 people to do this.
Yeah,
That's wild. Then now he literally did it overnight using, you know, a bunch of the off-the-shelf tools. And so, I guess, who knows? I don't know. We'll see.
So good. Fantastic. All right. I'm going to keep us on track. I know there's probably lots of great questions. Catch Dan before he heads out tonight. Let's give it up one more time for Dan Park. Clutch.ca. Before we go, and of course, my fearless co-founder.
What's happening?
Thomas J. Holmes. Call her. That's weird. Now people will hack your banking. They know your middle name.
Just the initials.
A couple quick thank yous before we go. Again, thanks to Rewind and Rebuy for helping put on this night. It's weird to thank PB&J because, like, that's us. But, like, thanks,
thank
PB&J.
Yourselves.
We
thank
put
you.
This on.
Well, thank you, PB&J. There you go.
Thanks, Dan. And the bigger, Ashley and Alex and Amber, the Soho staff that pulled this off. Thank you very much. We got Lewis and Jason and Dan. We got the whole crew. And we've got you. Thank you for coming out. Thanks for coming out to the chef's table. Soho House Toronto. Actually, I think contractually I'm not allowed to say Soho House Toronto, so we'll have to edit that out. But we are not here. Thank you so much. Desserts coming out. There's drinks. You don't have to wait. We can stay here for a bit. Have some desserts, have some drinks, make some connections, and we'll see you next time.
Cool. Thank you.